Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston City Council meets today and votes on restrictions to short-term rentals.
Short-term rentals are contributing to this public health crisis, and without regulation, stands to become an even larger contributor to displacement.
Also today, there are two different efforts in state government to expand civics education in Massachusetts classrooms.
They want to be leaders, but they don't have the faintest idea how they're governed.
Plus, North America wins the right to host the 2026 World Cup.
Canada, Mexico, and USA have been selected by the FIFA Congress to host the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
And what's one word you'd use to describe a 64-foot-long paper airplane?
Big.
How about?
Very extravagant.
That's more like it. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Boston City Council voted today to pass stricter regulations on short-term rentals through platforms such as Airbnb. Here's City Councilor Ayanna Pressley on why she supported the ordinance.
Short-term rentals are contributing to this public health crisis and epidemic that is the affordable housing crisis, and without regulation or data collection, stands to become an even larger contributor to displacement.
Well, WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zanindra Enwemeka was at the city council meeting today, and she joins us now from Boston City Hall. Hi there, Zanindra.
Hey, Meghna.
So there's been a lot of back and forth for several months about exactly what changes to short-term rentals might happen in Boston. So let's just kind of go through step by step on what the city council did today. First of all, there was a proposed cap from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh about putting a 120-day cap on short-term rentals for 2- and 3-family homes, owner-occupied ones. What happened there?
Yes. So that was in the original proposal, as you mentioned, that the mayor put forth. So what happened since then is that the city council had a working session where they, you know, discussed that ordinance. And since then, before today, there is actually an amendment added to remove that 120-day cap on 2- and 3-family homes. So what the city council voted on today basically allows for 365 days a year if someone in one of those units wants to rent them out on a short-term basis.
I see. Okay, so that was quite a sticking point there. So just to be clear, folks who own 2- and 3-family homes, if they live in one of the units, will be able to go forward and rent the other ones with no cap. Okay, interesting. Now, what about...
No cap. And basically what you were referring to there is Councilor O'Malley did introduce a proposed amendment to reinstate that cap. But that failed in a vote today.
Got it. Okay, so what about the other major issue, which was investor-owned units outright, not 2- and 3-family, but just all of those couple of thousand units in Boston that are owned by absentee investors? What happened there?
Oh, well, so the city council gave basically a resounding no to investor units. So this is basically when people use properties that they don't live in and put them up for short-term rentals on sites like Airbnb. The city council was very clear today that they were not accepting even a limited use of investor units. And so they completely rejected that, and that is not in the ordinance.
Okay. So because I remember in previous conversations we've had on Radio Boston about this issue, the Boston Housing Chief Sheila Dillon has said that the one of their goals is to get those units back online for regular rental for 12-month leases. But on the other hand, if I understand correctly, Zeninger, today at the city council, we had some city councilors wanting to allow investors to have their units on Airbnb. And so let's play some tape here. Here's City Councilor Frank Baker.
I'm concerned that completely eliminating investor units will push all the short-term rentals out of downtown and into the surrounding neighborhoods where the most affordable housing exists today.
So, Zeninder, am I hearing that right? That Councilor Baker was saying if they don't allow investor-owned units, say, I don't know, in the seaport or downtown to rent on Airbnb, that he's worried that in the surrounding areas of Boston where lower cost housing is, that that's where the Airbnb rentals might go?
Yeah, you know, so Meghna, this gets at a really interesting divide that's been popping up in all of this discussion around short-term rentals between the neighborhoods that are more concentrated in downtown Boston versus the neighborhoods in the outer parts of the city. And so a lot of the councilors representing those communities outside of the downtown core of Boston are very concerned about the impact and about residents there having the flexibility to use short-term rental services, and also about, you know, shutting down investor units in the downtown areas and what that will do to housing costs, to the availability of units in outer neighborhoods. Whereas councilors who are more in the downtown areas, who represent those areas, are very concerned about properties just being completely snapped up. And so there was some support today in the city council for allowing investor units in some capacity. Some of the arguments were about allowing for competition in the short-term rental housing market.
Mm. But just so that we're clear, as you said earlier, the city council ultimately voted against having investor-owned units be on short-term rentals.
Yeah, ultimately, okay. They were not buying those arguments and are banning investor units in Boston.
One more quick thing, Zeninger. You know, data collection around housing is a really big deal in Boston. Were there any amendments regarding that today?
So there's discussion around making sure, and there were some amendments around basically making sure that there's some transparency around the data that's collected on short-term housing rentals, that that this ordinance is proposing to create a registry on short-term rentals, that that's made public. So there were some amendments in what was voted on today to do that and to make that an easier process. There was also quite a bit of discussion about the city really focusing on data moving forward once this ordinance is in place and giving themselves the flexibility to further down the road be able to look at that data, assess it, and possibly make some changes to this ordinance.
Yeah. Now, Airbnb has been very vocal about its opposition to any regulation to short-term rentals in Boston. Have we had a response from them since the city council just took its vote a little while ago?
Yes, I just caught a Airbnb spokesperson who was at the hearing today just as it ended, and I know they've released a statement. They're not happy with what happened today in a nutshell. They're very concerned about the regulations. They believe they're a bit too strict. They are concerned that there's so much focus on multifamily homes when Boston is mostly a city of renters, and that those renters, if they have the approval of their landlord, should be able to have the flexibility of, you know, potentially using a site like Airbnb to do a short-term rental. So they are not happy with the measure today, and they, you know, are basically looking to see kind of what happens next moving forward.
Now, I know I keep saying last question, but this time it is the last one, Zeninger.
Yeah,
Boston Mayor, the ordinance now goes back to Mayor Walsh. Is he likely to sign it? Because there are some changes from what he originally wanted.
There are some changes. And, you know, going back to that 120-day cap, that's the biggest change. And that was what Mayor Walsh initially wanted. He wanted that 120-day cap on these multifamily units. The city council voted today to get rid of that cap. And so he does have the ability to veto this ordinance, and we'll have to see what happens. I believe he has expressed that he does reserve that right if he's not happy with the changes that the city council has approved.
Well, that's WBUR's Bostonomics reporter Zeninja and Wemeka bringing us up to speed on today's Boston City Council vote regarding short-term rentals. Zeninja, it was terrific to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem, Meghna.
Well, this week, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions made a significant change to U.S. asylum rules that now make it virtually impossible for asylum seekers to win entry into the United States based on fears of gang violence or domestic abuse. Sessions said on Monday that he believes too many people are taking advantage of what he views as a loophole in the Immigration and Nationality Act, or INA.
Under the INA, asylum is available for those who leave their home country because of persecution or fear on account of race, religion, nationality, or membership in a particular social group or political opinion. Asylum was never meant to alleviate all problems, even all serious problems, that people face every day all over the world.
Sessions' decision came in a ruling that he made in a closely scrutinized domestic violence case. He reversed an immigration appeals court ruling that granted asylum to a Salvadoran woman who had said she'd been sexually, emotionally, and physically abused by her husband. So for some reaction, we're joined now by Sarah Sherman Stokes. She's the Associate Director of the Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Clinic at Boston University, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So what was your initial reaction when the Attorney General made this decision?
Well, this decision is devastating for our clients and for immigrant communities in the United States and for people who are fleeing serious violence from all over the world.
Okay. How many people who seek asylum in the United States are currently claiming these domestic violence or gang violence related fears?
So it's longstanding that people who suffer violence by, quote, private actors like gang members or abusive partners or spouses can get asylum in the United States. In his decision, Sessions overturned basically 20 years of asylum jurisprudence that grants asylum to people who have suffered this kind of harm. So it's a pretty sweeping decision that has the potential to affect a lot of my clients and clients in this community.
I'll come back to that in a second, but tell us a little bit more about some of the claims that your clients are making. I mean, what are the fears specifically that they have? Granted, I know that every case is individual, but can you give us some examples?
Certainly. And I think it is important to point out that every case is individual. One of the other things that Sessions does in this decision is prejudge a lot of these cases by saying they should all basically be denied without individually considering the merits of each case, which is what asylum law is meant to do. In terms of my clients, they've made claims not dissimilar from the claims of Ms. A.B., the immigrant whose case is at issue in this decision. Many of my clients are survivors of pretty significant domestic violence. They've been physically, sexually, and emotionally abused in their home countries. I have other clients. I presently have two child clients, siblings, whose parents were murdered by gang members in their home country, and they then fled to the United States seeking protection. I don't think that their case is over after this decision, but it certainly will become more difficult.
Hmm. So I want to focus on the domestic violence claims for a second here, because gang violence is also kind of a different thing, equally thorny. But to the Attorney General's point earlier in the tape that we heard, he's basically making the argument that asylum laws are set up to protect or grant asylum to people who need protection from the persecution of the government in their home country. Mm-hmm. And that domestic violence, while terrible, is not persecution by a government. If anything, it's failure of a home government to protect its individual citizens. But that's not necessarily the responsibility of the United States. So I mean, what's your response to that?
Yeah. Unfortunately, all 11 circuit courts disagree with him. So in fact, it's long understood that people who are the survivors of private violence can get protection in the United States. If you suffer harm from a private actor, you simply must show that your government is either unable or unwilling to protect you.
So you have to prove government negligence here.
That's correct.
Maybe negligence isn't the right word, but unwillingness to protect.
Inability or unwillingness to protect.
Okay. And but so that seems like actually a pretty high bar. How do asylum seekers go about proving that?
It is. And asylum seekers have done and will continue to do what they've always done, which is to present copious amounts of country conditions evidence and testimony from country experts that corroborate that some home country governments fail to protect survivors of domestic violence. For example, a client of mine might go to the police in her home country and report that she is being abused by her partner. And oftentimes the police will say, that's a private matter, that's a family matter, we're not going to get involved. Or, you're the property of your husband, we can't help you. So that is direct evidence that a government, that the law enforcement agency of that country is refusing essentially to protect that survivor of domestic violence.
Hmm. You know, this might be a slight repeat of what we just talked about, but I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of those Americans who wholly support Attorney General Sessions' decision. And they do see the claim of needing asylum based on domestic violence as a loophole in U.S. immigration laws. I mean, what would you say to them?
Yeah. Respectfully, I strongly disagree. Asylum has never been a loophole. Asylum is a very high bar. People have to provide significant evidence of the harm and persecution they suffered and the harm and persecution they would suffer if forced to return to their home countries. This is not a loophole. It is enshrined in the statute. It complies with our obligations under international refugee treaties. If Congress wants to change the law, they can do that. But this is the law as it stands now. And the idea that Sessions advances that these migrants, that these refugees are taking advantage of some kind of loophole or are trying to game the system is just false.
Hmm. Well, let's play a little bit more from Attorney General Sessions here because he was speaking to a group of immigration judges. And he basically reminded them that nevertheless, regardless of what he says, their fundamental job is still to rule on individual cases fairly.
It will be your duty, of course, to carry that out. This decision will provide more clarity for you. It will help you to rule consistently and all our judges to rule consistently throughout the country and fairly.
What's your response to that?
That's nice, paying nice lip service to judicial independence, but I think it's contradicted by the language of his decision, which states unequivocally, quote, generally claims by non-citizens pertaining to domestic violence or gang violence perpetrated by non-governmental actors will not qualify for asylum. That's sending a pretty strong message to adjudicators about the decisions they should make in these cases.
Hmm. So let's talk about gang violence for a moment, because I know in many of the, especially Central and South American nations, that is one of the major reason why people are fleeing, because it's ubiquitous and terrible. What do you think that this is going to stop a lot of people from trying to come to the United States to seek asylum based on the violence in their hometowns or villages?
So the idea that this decision is going to deter people, I think, is misplaced. It's very difficult to deter people who have no other choice. Many of my clients attempted to seek safety within their home countries. They didn't want to leave their families and their communities behind, but they were left with no choice. Many of them tried to relocate internally in their home countries. They went into hiding. They went to other cities and neighborhoods, but still they were unsafe. Still the gangs found them, or still their abusers found them. They only came to the United States when they had no other option.
Hmm. So what's going to happen to your clients now who are in the process of seeking asylum in the United States?
Right. We're not sure. I think we are all waiting with bated breath to see how this plays out in some ways. We're also, trying to craft creative, novel legal arguments. While I think this is a devastating decision, I also don't want to be alarmist. We do still have strong legal footing to make these claims. We still have good case law on our side, and we still have the law. Sessions did a lot in this decision, but he did not change the legal standard. He simply reinterpreted a legal standard. I will say, fortunately, that my clients have a lawyer. Many people do not have a lawyer in immigration proceedings, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges coming out of this case, is that now we're expecting pro se or unrepresented immigrants who are seeking asylum to navigate this increasingly complex system on their own.
Just for a bit of clarity, though, I mean, so you said that the Attorney General didn't change the law. He reinterpreted a legal standard. But I also heard you say a couple of minutes ago that he was pretty clear in his interpretation to immigration judges. So which one is it? Do immigration judges still have some legal leeway here?
I think they do. I think part of that will be dependent on the immigration judge herself and what she chooses to do. But I do. There is still good persuasive authority and good law on her side. And I think Sessions' decision is wrong.
Well, that's Sarah Sherman Stokes. She's the Associate Director of the Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Clinic at Boston University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Wednesday, so time for sports. And with me is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Meghna, how's it going?
It's going great. Excellent. Let's start with something to celebrate.
On behalf of our united bid, Canada, Mexico, and my country, the United States, thank you so, so very much for this incredible honor. Thank you for entrusting us with this privilege, the privilege of hosting the FIFA World Cup in 2026.
Woohoo! That's Carlos Cordero, president of the U.S. Soccer Federation. Because just today, North America, underscore that part, was announced as the winner to jointly bid, well, I guess U.S., Canada, Mexico, the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Are you ready to buy your tickets, Bill?
I'm not sure I can afford my tickets because part of the promise that this joint bid made to FIFA was that they would generate not only record crowds, but also $11 billion for FIFA. And I don't know what my part of the $11 billion would be if I buy a ticket or two, but I'm somewhat cowed.
I don't know. Okay, so maybe 50, 60, 100, 200 bucks. That.
Yeah, that would be to watch it on a big screen outside the stadium, I think.
Okay.
Well,
Foxborough, maybe.
Yeah,
we don't yet know, but wouldn't that be cool?
Well,
I've seen some international games there. It's
absolutely
a great spot.
Absolutely, and all they have to do is you know, bring in the grass, and they can do it. So it's very nice. It's a terrible stadium to watch soccer, I've got to be honest with you. And why the Kraft family hasn't built a soccer stadium, I don't know. But that's up to them.
Although, okay, so this takes us a little bit away from FIFA, but I once saw an international game there, and we sat on the on Guatemala's side.
Mm-hmm.
And man,
oh, it's great,
like,
fun.
The fans
don't get me wrong. I'm just saying it's a football stadium.
And
if you've ever been in a real legitimate soccer stadium in a country where, or even here, where an MLS team with a soccer dedicated stadium plays, it's a different experience than seeing a soccer game in a football stadium. That's the only point I'm making. Not to say I wouldn't go. I mean, if there are World Cup games down the road, certainly try and be there.
$11 billion might make a lot of changes in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. But let me ask you about that. Did you think it made a difference that this was a joint bid between the three North and Central American countries, I guess, North American?
Well, I think what made a difference is there wasn't very much competition. I mean, the only competition was Morocco. And Morocco is not ready to host a big soccer tournament. There would be a tremendous amount of building that would be necessary, whereas the United States, Mexico, and Canada combined pretty much have in place what they would have to provide FIFA for the tournament. Although I hope that Canada promises that they will provide stadiums with grass rather than doing what they did during the last Women's World Cup, which is
turf?
Like it or lump it, play on turf.
No.
Obviously, the Men's World Cup is not going to play on turf. And I hope no Women's World
Women,
Cup ever
though?
Will again. Yeah, it was awful.
That's
it was stupid.
Terrible.
Yeah, the women tried to organize a protest and they did the best they could to try to get a legitimate surface to play on, and Canada wouldn't budge, so that's where it was.
Okay, Canada, don't let us down here. We'll leave it for the United States to let Canada down in recent days, but that's a separate story.
No, the other problem with a bid potentially is if Donald Trump can create the impression that he should be president for life, Canada and Mexico may pull out. I mean, they may say, the heck with it. You don't like us, we don't like you. Do it yourself, pal.
I'm trying to keep politics out of sports for once.
How can you?
I screwed
it
up.
Be done.
But one thing we should note, that this vote that FIFA took today was made in public, a change from past years where they chose a future World Cup host. Tell us about that.
Well, I think FIFA or the at least some of the people who haven't already been arrested and incarcerated connected with FIFA have – I think the organization as a whole is probably making an effort to appear more transparent, more honest, less corrupt than they have been in the past. Now – granted, it's a low bar. It's not very hard to do that.
There were people arrested by the FBI corruption.
There were envelopes with $40,000 in them sliding under hotel room doors, things of that nature. But I think that this the public vote is part of the effort to say, hey, look, we're going to try to at least convince you that we're not quite the brigands that we have been in the past.
Okay. You know, so we may not really have a functioning North American free trade agreement now, but we have a North American football agreement.
We do.
I love
we do.
It. We should talk about the actual 2018 World Cup, which is starting tomorrow in Russia. There have already been some big headlines, like Spain firing its head coach all of a sudden.
Yeah, what a great way to prepare for the World Cup. 48 hours before your first game, fire the head coach because he failed to tell you that he is going to next be the coach at Real Madrid.
Whoops.
It sounds like a rather, I don't know, abrupt decision perhaps. But who knows? I mean, this may be just the kind of thing that – and apparently the Spanish players were very upset and they liked their head coach. But who knows? This is the sort of thing sometimes that that really sets a fire under a group of players and they may say, the heck with you, we're going to win the darn thing anyway.
Yeah. And but so the one team that can't say that is the USA because they didn't qualify.
They can say it, but nobody will listen. Because they aren't there.
It's a bummer. I mean, okay. Well, we'll see how it goes. And the World Cup kicks off tomorrow, so there'll be lots of football talk for us on Wednesdays for the next couple of weeks.
Yep.
So before we run out of time, Bill, let's turn to baseball. There is an all-star vote going on, and Mookie Betts of the Sox, super popular. Major League Baseball just released round one of the results for the fan vote for this year's all-star game, and Betts has received almost 750,000 votes in the outfielder category. Mm-hmm. Not bad, right?
No, it's very good. I think there's several things that factor into that. One is he's hitting .354, which is about 60 points over his career average. So he's having a terrific year so far. He's got 17 home runs. And the other is he's named Mookie. And it's very, very hard to vote against somebody named Mookie. I mean, people pout at you if you vote against someone named Mookie.
Of course. And also, he's, like you said, he's very, very good.
He's very good,
so
yes. He's
multiple
very good at
reasons.
Playing
the
baseball
game. Okay. Well, I hope that as the rounds go on, he keeps it up because what a great guy. Okay. One last thing that I want to talk to you about, and that is the PGA, at the PGA, the U.S. Open going on, and Tiger Woods, 42 years old now, not that there's anything wrong with that, 42, is by far the media highlight for the U.S. Open, which starts tomorrow in New York. Now, he is trying to win what would be his first major championship in 10 years.
Right.
We've just got a little bit of tape here. Here's Tiger at a press conference yesterday.
You know, there's so many young players out here and guys with so much talent, but you know, in the end, it just takes a little bit more experience and a little more time to develop.
Do you think he's got a shot at it, though?
I think it's really striking that golf writers are starting their articles about and their columns about the Open by saying, well, Tiger Woods kind of squeaked in there into the field via an exemption and this and that and the other thing. But now that he's in there, anything could happen. This seems to me desperate. It's almost like Tiger is the story, and then on the tournaments that he doesn't show up for or doesn't qualify for or you know, leaves the tournament after 2 days because he doesn't make the cut, there's almost like then it's desperate scrambling for something else to write about. I wish they'd stop. Mm. I wish they'd leave him alone. And maybe he has another major win in him, but I got to doubt it at this point with the physical damage and all these young players that he talks about. I just think it's kind of nutty that they're still making him topic one when they write about a big tournament.
Yeah. I'm looking at my director now. I'm going to go over time just here a little bit. He's giving me the thumbs up, so we're okay. Because I want to, I mean, all this talk about like aging players. I'm going to move to tennis here for a second because world number one, Rafael Nadal, won the French Open this weekend. He beat a 24-year-old. It's Nadal's 11th French Open win. And here he is at a press conference right after winning.
You can't fight against the age and you can't fight against the watch. That is the watch. Keep going always. If you tell me 7-8 years ago that I will be here with 32 years old having this trophy with me again, I will tell you that it's something almost impossible, but here we are.
So I think, Bill, the reason why I want to play it is I might be entering a phase in my life where hearing someone say, I couldn't believe I'd be here at the age of 32. Of course! He's the number one tennis player in the world!
Yes, especially when they play in France. If they keep playing these tournaments in France, he may win 10 more.
And why not? Okay, that's enough. I'm talking about world famous number one saying, oh, I can't believe I'm still here at the creaky old age of 32. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only Game, which airs on WBUR on Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. You will always be timeless to me, Bill.
Thank you, Meghna. What a nice thing for you to say.
Okay, picture a paper airplane. And how big is this paper airplane that you're thinking about? I'm going to guess it's probably the size of a piece of paper. So, okay, now imagine that this particular paper airplane is big. Really, really big. I'm talking 64 feet long big. Well, that is exactly how long a paper airplane project in Fitchburg turned out to be. And for more on that story and some other arts headlines, we're joined now by Amy Gorell, producing editor at WBUR's The Artery. Amy, it's good to have you on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So I saw pictures of this airplane at WBUR.org, and it's absolutely awesome. So to the folks who haven't seen it yet, tell us what it looks like.
Yeah, so this is a project organized by Jerry Beck. He's the founder and artistic director of the public art organization, the Revolving Museum. And you might be thinking that this is just one big sheet of paper, but that's not quite right. It's 64 feet long, like you said, and it's made out of corrugated cardboard, the same stuff that cardboard boxes are made out of.
Okay, so it has actual structure then lot of paper. Okay.
And it kind of needs that because it also weighs 1,500 pounds, and 64 feet is really long. That's longer than those Silver Line buses with the bendy part in the middle. It was unveiled yesterday at the Fitchburg Municipal Airport, and it got quite a reaction. Here's 17-year-old Fitchburg High School student Matthew Croach, who's also a member of the Fitchburg Cultural Council.
We knew that this project would be big and, you know, just very extravagant, but we didn't really imagine that it would be this big. I mean, there are people from all over the state here right now in Fitchburg.
I love how he says extravagant, because that's what it sounds like to me. Lots of cardboard holding up all that paper, but it's still a paper airplane. So what is it covered with?
Right. Well, from top to bottom, it's completely covered in art. There's paintings, drawings, prints, poems, even images of Facebook posts. There was more than 5,000 people that actually contributed to this project. And getting a lot of people together to work on these outrageously large projects is sort of the thing that Jerry Beck is known for. He started the Revolving Museum a few decades back to orchestrate these massive creative public works. Here's Jerry at the unveiling, emphasizing the importance of creativity.
Every important movement in the world, artists have been at the forefront. Sometimes we forget that. And it's about your creativity that's important. It's not about if you could do a perfect painting in a museum. It's about being creative in your everyday life.
I love that sentiment, to be perfectly honest, Amy. And it's significant also that this paper airplane project was made in Fitchburg, right?
Right. So Fitchburg was one of these classic mill towns, like Lowell in the 1800s with textiles. Beck says Fitchburg was once one of the top three paper-making cities in the world. And that connection is really driven home with this project. The city is framing this art, which is completely made out of paper, as a symbol of the city's future. They're saying that it's time for a revival in Fitchburg.
Love it. Well, but I really want to know, it was unveiled at the Fitchburg Municipal Airport. Did it fly?
Well, no.
Okay.
I think it might have started out that way a few years ago, but then the project sort of took on a life of its own. The wings aren't quite wide enough to let the plane go airborne, and the plane is far too heavy to fly at about 1,500 pounds.
Now, technically speaking, 1,500 pounds isn't too heavy to fly because, like, jets are super heavy, but that's okay. But if you're a paper airplane and you're 1,500 pounds, I get it. Maybe it didn't take off this time. But still, great project. And again, we've got links to images of the paper airplane in Fitchburg at radioboston.org. Now, Amy, while you're here, I want to talk about a couple of other art stories that have been featured on The Artery. One that caught your attention recently was a collection of works by an artist named Michelle Lugie, and her chosen media is plastic bags.
That's right. I'm sure, you know, as you and many listeners are aware, that there's a lot of growing concern about plastic waste making its way into our oceans and harming the marine life there. And there's something called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's this large trash vortex out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And that news really hit home with Cambridge artist Michelle Lugie.
Okay, so what then does she do? What does her exhibit look like?
Right, so she takes these plastic bags that she finds. Sometimes she just plucks them right off of trees in her neighborhood and crochets them into these fantastic tentacly creatures. It's a project that really mixes art and activism. And her exhibit opens today at the Boston Sculptors Gallery.
Today. Okay, terrific. Sounds like it's well worth taking a look at. Well, there's another story I want to talk about before we let you go, Amy. And this is one we should touch on because it's about the proposed Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Boston. Now, city officials have announced the five artist finalists who want to compete to design the project. But I think perhaps more importantly, Boston has actually expanded the scope of the memorial. So tell us about that.
Right. Well, we've known for a while that the city wanted to create a memorial to the Kings, but now we know quite how big it's going to be. The memorial actually now has several components to it. You know, there's the actual memorial on Boston Common. Mm-hmm. And then they're also talking about having an educational experience in Dudley Square, which we don't know more than that right now. And there's also plans for an endowment for King-related programming at Roxbury's 12th Baptist Church. That's the church where King worshipped and preached when he was a doctorate student at Boston University.
Okay, so the actual memorial plus educational experiences and funding for King-related programming. That is quite a bit bigger than we had heard about before. But in addition, the memorial is not just to Dr. King himself, right?
That's right. This is a really noteworthy memorial, I think, because it's for both him and his wife, Coretta Scott King. It's going to be built in the city that Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott fell in love in, and it's really intended to be a testament to their relationship and to both of their legacies.
All right. So what then can we expect happening next with this memorial?
Right now, the five finalists will be given $10,000 stipends to develop their proposals for the memorial, and city officials say that those five proposals will be available for public viewing in September. The final project has a budget of about $3 to $5 million, and there's hope to have a finalist chosen by November.
Aha. Okay. Well, that would be terrific if they can stay on track. Well, for right now, we've got a link to the Artery's write-up of those five finalists for the Martin Luther King Memorial. That link is at radioboston.org. Amy Gorell, producing editor at WBUR's The Artery, thank you so much. It was great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Magda.
We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakraborty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Magna Chakraborty. The debate over whether Massachusetts students receive enough civics instruction isn't necessarily a new one. In 2009, the state actually created a civics component for the MCAS, only to have then-Governor Deval Patrick nix the idea due to the $2.4 million price tag. But the tide of public support for a more robust civics curriculum may be turning as both the House and the Senate on Beacon Hill overwhelmingly passed versions of a civics education bill in recent weeks. Senate President Harriet Chandler, who has filed a number of civics education bills over the years, talked with us about why she feels this is such an important issue.
I've been going to schools for a number of years now, getting students to sign up to vote if they're almost of age. And what I've learned is that they're interested, they want to be leaders, but they don't have the faintest idea how they're governed.
Well, at the same time that legislation is being considered, the State Board of Elementary and Secondary Education is planning an update to the History and Social Sciences curriculum framework, a multi-year process that culminates in a vote by the board at the end of the month. Now, for more on civics in the classroom, let's turn to Arielle Jennings. She's executive director for Generation Citizen Massachusetts. They helped draft both the new curriculum framework and the Senate bill that passed, by the way, 32-4, so overwhelmingly. Arielle, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And I should say you're joining us from Brighton, England today, is that right?
I am indeed.
Oh, okay. Also with us is Jessica Lander. She's a civics teacher at Lowell High School and a contributor to the Boston Globe. Jessica, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me just start with you, Ariel, and give us a sense about this bill pending on Beacon Hill. We heard Senate President Chandler there. If it ultimately passes and becomes law, what would it hope to accomplish?
The civics bill is very exciting and potentially very transformational for Massachusetts. If passed, it would require that all schools infuse civics education from the K-12 curriculum. And in addition, it would ask schools to integrate project-based civics, something we call action civics, into classrooms where students actually go out and have real-world experience engaging with local government and civic leaders.
Uh-huh.
The civics bill also calls for, on the Senate side, a $1.5 million budget to make this possible every year and support districts and schools and teachers in professional development
right.
So this can get done.
So I'm looking at the bill here, and it says the education shall include instructions in the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration, the Constitution of the Commonwealth, interestingly, local history and government, and programs relating to the flag of the United States of America. But most importantly, a line here saying to prepare students morally and intellectually for the duties of citizenship. So Jessica Lander, I mean, you're in the classroom every day. Is this not happening right now? Not necessarily in your classroom, but like in classrooms generally in Massachusetts.
So I think there are a lot of classrooms across Massachusetts are starting to do this work. And I think Lowell in particular has been really committed to ensuring that every student has an action-based civics approach. And really sort of building on what Ariel just said, that action civics, when we talk about it, is that civic knowledge, which you were mentioning, but also is two other key components. And that's the motivation. We want students to be engaged and want them to create change. And the civic tools, the skills they need to actually go out into the community and make that change possible. So I'm seeing really across the state some really exciting things happening in classrooms, but it's taking the leadership and vision of schools and districts to do this.
So I guess my question is, though, then why do we need this? Why do we need this bill?
So
I can jump in there, Jess. I think while there are these fantastic examples across schools and districts, we have actually seen over the last decade or so social studies, the teaching of history decline, and in particular subjects that have mandates to them for standardized tests increase in the resources that go to them. So
reading primarily, right?
Yeah. So we've actually seen social studies disappearing from some middle schools and civics courses in particular disappearing. So this bill will provide the resources for a resurgence in this and not only teach civics in a rote civic knowledge-based way, but one that invites those skills and dispositions to be taught as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is a major sticking point, I think, in a lot of, for some schools and parents, that because MCAS is such an important part of the state's view of education, that some districts tend to, whether on purpose or not, tailor the instructional time around what MCAS requires. And for as long, I mean, we were talking about how there was an effort a couple of years ago to get civics or social studies in as an MCAS test, but that failed. Anyway, moving on. Jessica, look, I got kids in school right now, so I'm awash in all of this. But Jessica, let me ask you, I mean, again, you're working with young people every day.
Yeah.
And we are living in a time right now due to the current political moments, due to technology and the media, where, you know, on the one hand, especially when we're talking about middle schoolers and high schoolers, they're kind of awash in politics, not necessarily civics. I mean, mm-hmm. How much do you get a sense as do they naturally know about how government is supposed to work?
So my students don't always know when we start off at the beginning of the year, and I teach U.S. history and then a seminar on American diversity and that history. They don't always know how government works in the beginning, but what I am really inspired is all my students want to make a difference. And so I think we're then combining those three elements, that motivation, that drive, with the knowledge that they need to make a difference and the skills they need to make a difference. But my students across the board care deeply about their community. And I teach almost all recent immigrants and refugees from more than 30 different countries.
Uh-huh.
And they have made America their new home, and they are so excited and passionate about making their community a better place. And so the question for us as teachers is, how do we give them the skills and the knowledge to allow them to do that?
Now, you do some experiential civics education.
Absolutely.
What practically speaking, what does that look like?
Yeah, so it takes many different forms. And that's sort of what's exciting about Action Civics, is that it looks different depending on what your goal is. So, for example, in the winter, we're studying the progressive era, and we're looking at muckraker journalists who shed light on social issues. And I have my students then, as the culmination of that, go write op-eds on issues they care about. And we learn how to write an op-ed. I'm a journalist myself. They write on bullying and on mental health and on the ideas of virtual technology in the classroom. And excitingly for us in Lowell, the Lowell Sun has published some of the 10 best op-eds each year. Hmm. And so, like, that's one type of Action Civics. But then in the spring, we partner with Generation Citizen, and each class takes on a full-on project to try to create change. So to make it concrete, last spring, students in one class decided that hunger was the issue they wanted to care about, because they had lots of friends who were coming to them saying that they were hungry on the weekends. They have their own, some of them have their own experiences with hunger. And so they started talking to experts, they started talking to local nonprofits, and they decided that they wanted to open up a school-based food pantry. And so then they had to do that hard work. And those are the tools and the skills. They had to write memos. They had to do cost analysis. They had to meet with faculty members and with nonprofits. And what's really exciting, what I love about Action Civics, is this fall, those kids opened up a school-based food pantry in our school in partnership with the Merrimack Valley Food Bank. And it's been serving kids all year.
Wow. Well, Arielle Jennings, to get sort of back to some of the practical differences between the Senate and House versions of this bill, we were just talking about the student-led projects. I understand that that those student-led projects would be required for graduation in the Senate version of the bill, but the House makes these projects optional. It seems like there's a concern on the House side for making it a requirement.
Yes, that is the fundamental difference between the two bills, and hopefully will be reconciled in the next couple of weeks in a committee. I think there are pros and cons to a mandate for the civics projects. From the pros argument, I think that requiring schools to do this and providing a mandate, we've seen in the education system resources flow where a mandate exists. We see this with standardized tests. So it would allow for resources to be funneled to teachers to do this good work. In particular, we see huge disparities in action-based civics as it relates to wealthier communities and lower-income communities. So it would ensure that all schools are doing this work, and therefore all young people are prepared for citizenship. On the cons, it certainly is a lot to expect from schools. The resources will be high, and to add another graduation requirement for students is a burden on them. And so if there is a way, if the mandate does not remain, but for large incentives to be put in place for districts and schools to do this, hopefully they can come up with a creative way to still highly incentivize it without a mandate.
Yeah. I want to play a little bit more tape from Senate President Harriet Chandler, because there's also a media literacy component in the legislation. Mm-hmm. And it's one that Senate President Chandler says that she feels is perhaps one of the most important parts of the bill.
Being able to analyze news media is very important across all grade levels, because it's the skills like reading a piece of journalism. It's skills like listening to our media and determining, is this fake news or is this real? And how do you determine that? How do you analyze its legitimacy? How do you understand and where do you go to find out its relevancy?
Now, I have to say, obviously, I am not totally objective about this because I'm in the media, but I think this is vitally important, right? Because information is the currency of our time, right? But Jessica, when I heard Senate President Chandler say that, I thought, okay, so there's these concrete skills, media literacy, understanding the civic machinery in terms of how government is supposed to work, understanding what your rights are, what our laws actually say and how they're created. But there's also politics here, right? Because, I mean, I guess, is it hard to, do you try to keep politics or political views out of the classroom when you're teaching civics? Is that even possible?
It's hard to keep politics out, but we are trying to approach it from a historical angle and to look at placing the politics in history. And so how are we understanding it based, and I'm an American history teacher, so putting it in perspective. But I think the key point that I'm excited about the media literacy component is that my students are reading the news all the time and they're coming to me, have you read this? Is this true? And they don't yet, again, have the tools to understand and for themselves figure out if that's true or not. And so this needs to be an essential component of what we're teaching in schools, along with action civics. And both are just going to empower students.
Yeah. You know, Arielle Jennings, I have a quick question for you, because one of the things that I think I've heard from a lot of Massachusetts teachers over the past many years is they love their jobs and they want the freedom and independence to teach each child to the best ability that they can. This could also be seen as another top-down mandate from the state, though. I mean, are teachers going to be given the time and training to expand their skills in curriculum?
I think it's going to take a lot of infrastructure to make this work. I think the $1.5 million budget attached to this bill that can occur year after year will be a very important resource to have. And frankly, if that is not attached to the bill is probably not worthwhile to pass. And I also think it's going to take leadership from districts like we've seen in Lowell, Massachusetts, and the support of districts to make common planning time for teachers and professional development time.
Yeah.
So it will be an effort that is large but definitely worthwhile. Our education system in this country was founded on the premise to prepare young people for civic life and for a democracy. So it's really important to recommit to that effort in the state of Massachusetts.
Right. Go back to the language of this bill that says it's to prepare students morally and intellectually for the duties of citizenship or residency or just being active members of your community. It seems vitally important that we help students achieve those goals however we can. Well, Jessica Lander, social studies teacher at Lowell High School and a contributor to the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me in.
And Arielle Jennings, executive director for Generation Citizen Massachusetts, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, what do you think? Should Massachusetts be pushing more civics education into classrooms? Let us know. Go to radioboston.org to send us a comment or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.